Welcome everyone to Dallas Philosopher's Forum. I'm going to go ahead and get started. Dallas Philosopher's Forum is dedicated to bring philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to the Dallas area. We all ready? Get started. Can y'all hear me in the back? How's the mic doing?
I don't think it's really working, but we can hear
you. Is that better? Okay. Anyway, welcome to everyone. To another session of the Dallas Philosopher's Forum. I'm Rob Olson. I want to welcome everyone and thank you for coming out. We meet on the second and fourth Tuesday of every month, so we start in September, and we go through a normal university or college school year through the end of May, the second and fourth Tuesday of every month. Any first-time visitors here? Okay, welcome. Welcome. Now, how did y'all hear about us?
Our philosophy professor and Google.
Who's that?
Dr. Nathan
Judd, the Western State University. Oh, okay, yes. Okay, awesome. Yeah, he spoke on
anarchism,
that's right, yes. Yeah. And Goldberg, yes. That was, and what about you all?
From me,
okay. Very good. Okay, excellent. Well, welcome. We're really glad you're here. If you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after the lecture. Our esteemed treasurer, David Alcat, gets $5, but if you're a student, it's $2. Student with an ID, and if you want to be a subscriber, it costs us $35 for 6 months. And then also, please, I want to remind you to pay your bill afterwards, and be generous with your wait staff. They work hard to make it an enjoyable evening for everyone. So, welcome, sir. So, every once in a while, someone will inadvertently forget to pay, and then we end up having to pay, and we're a not-for-profit organization, so please remember that. Does everyone have our fall schedule? This is available online, but I just wanted to mention that we've got hard copies of this. And we've got a lot of great topics coming up. We've got topics on capitalism, on Plato's treatment of justice in a Christian worldview. That's Dr. Robert Wood, also from University of Dallas. We have a University of Dallas theme going on this semester. We are very fortunate to have Dr. Rosen tonight with University of Dallas, and Dr. Wood with University of Dallas, and then Daniel Tomala, he studied under you.
And he teaches at the University of Dallas.
Oh, okay, I thought he just teaches at East Hill. He teaches at East Hill and at University of Dallas. Okay, excellent. Okay, and we have talks on Jainism and talks on Buddhist philosophy and phenomenology coming up later on this year. I want to recognize briefly our officers that work hard to make all this possible. David Drum is our vice president. David Alcat is our treasurer. Carla Kraft is our secretary. Jack Youngkin is marketing. Is Jack there? Ken Sauter does a great job with our AV. And Carl Meisenbach with marketing as well. And Carl set us up on the meetup. So I want to thank all of them for all their hard work. I wanted to ask everyone, do you all like the 7 p.m. starting time or the 7:30, or do you have a hard time getting here at the 7 p.m. and eating, or how is that working for you? Is it, there's more time afterwards to talk. Anyway, if you have comments about that, then see me afterwards. I want to mention that we have a website that has the same information, www.philosophersforum.org, and you can sign up on our email and get signed up as far as meetup as well. And then I would ask, last thing, please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate mode. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. We're very fortunate to have Dr. Philip Roseman with us tonight. He is a professor and chair of the philosophy department at the University of Dallas. I guess I've shamed you into, I've called him several times and shamed him into coming to speak to us tonight, and we're really, really excited about having him here. He received his undergraduate education at the University of Hamburg and at the University of London's Warburg Institute, and earned his PhD at the University Catholique de Louvain in Belgium. After graduation, he spent a year teaching at the Uganda Martyrs University, where he taught topics such as African philosophy and political philosophy, and we're fortunate to talk to him a little bit about his experiences in Africa and teaching philosophy there. Dr. Rosen has been at the University of Dallas since 1997. His main interests have revolved around the 12th century theologian Peter Lombard and his famous Book of Sentences. He is a noted scholar also in the area of medieval texts, text and translations. He'll be speaking this evening on language, alienation, inspiration, with remarks on Leonard Cohen's Going Home. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Philip Roseman.
Let me see if I can time it. And then Q&A. Q&A. Wonderful. Well, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. For every, well, of course, professor and intellectual, the greatest pleasure is always to have a group of people who are willing to sacrifice their time to listen to you and to your sometimes strange ideas and stories that you want to share. The topic for my presentation this evening, and it's already been said, is language, alienation, and inspiration. Perhaps I'd wait until the waiters are gone. What's the interest of this topic? Well, it's twofold, really. It's interesting to philosophize about language because language is one of the factors or one of the aspects that actually make us human. Sometimes it's said that it's rationality. Of course, rationality finds its expression in language, but of course also in art and so forth. So languages are important for every human being simply because language is for many of us. There's also art and music and so forth, so one has to be a little bit careful about this. But for many of us, language is the primary way in which we reflect on the meaning of human existence, of the world around us and so forth. So to inquire further into the nature of language, the human relationship with language and so forth, is of interest simply from a general human point of view. Language is also of significant interest for philosophers, because I can't say all philosophers, one of the reasons being that I don't know all philosophers, but certainly many philosophers view language as a privileged access to an understanding of reality. Take as an example Aristotle, who often in the metaphysics begins by talking about a term in the way in which it is generally used. So for example, Metaphysics, Book 5, Delta, is a philosophical dictionary in which Aristotle will say, okay, what does cause mean, what does principle mean, and so forth. And he will always start by saying, well, generally people use this term in the following way. And he will then not refute that, but will then take that as an avenue into what the term actually means. If you look at analytic philosophy, it's entirely, really, analysis of language. If you look at Heidegger, he at one point writes that all questioning is mysteriously, etc., etc., guided by language, etymological analysis of the roots of terms, and so forth. And so. The point that I really want to make here is twofold. Is it twofold? Just make that up on the spot. Perhaps it turns out to be threefold or even fourfold, especially after a couple of beers. No, I suppose it's just twofold. So the twofold point is this. Although language, see, is central to our being in the way in which I just explained, language is the way in which we reflect on our own existence and on reality. Just slightly distracted by the munching of chips. nonetheless, closer analysis shows that we are actually, although language seems to be so intimate to our being, we are actually alienated from language in ways that are both necessary, some are just structural and characterize human existence as such, others are due to, well, unfortunate, perhaps, political and economic circumstances. What to do about this alienation of language? Alienation, etymologically, or the term alienation actually means, comes from the Latin, alienus. That's another. So to be alienated from something means that something which I should recognize as my own actually turns out to be an undue influence of another over me. So my analysis is, that I'm trying to go to present, is that language, we'll be alienated from language in a number of ways, as I just said. What to do about it? Just recognize that it's unavoidable. and perhaps recognize that language ultimately has an origin beyond the human sphere, perhaps even a divine origin, as the poets have always thought. And that's why at the end we're going to listen to a contemporary song, which you're going to find strange, I think, and perhaps surprising and interesting. Let's see. Let me begin in the following way. Mr. Olson alluded to the fact that I lived in Africa for a while, which was certainly a fascinating experience and allowed for very, very significant both philosophical and personal growth. Part of the personal growth, by the way, consists in the strange experience for a person growing up in Europe that in Africa you can be the only white person in a 100-mile radius. And once you've appreciated that, you begin to appreciate what it can be like for a black person to be surrounded only by white people. It can be a bit strange. So, but at any rate, there's something else I learned in Uganda. I have students, obviously. I taught at Uganda Martyrs University. The students submitted essays to me that were so poorly written that I often have the difficulty, even with goodwill and a lot of time and effort, to figure out what the essays were trying to say. The English was so extremely bad. I remember often I wrote in the margin simply meaning, no idea what they were trying to express. So now I could say, okay, that's due to the fact that English is the second, third language for these people. It's not their native tongue. The native tongue, well, Uganda is a country that was created like other former colonies, right, in boundaries that don't reflect any, what should I say, real affinities among different tribes and people. So, some of the problems, you know, many of the problems in so-called third world countries are due to the fact that these people have to live in boundaries that do not reflect the actual demographic composition of the country. So in Uganda, for example, you have not only Christians and Muslims living together in the same country, which causes problems in Nigeria, for example, but you also have people from, which are so different in their cultural background that the languages they speak don't even belong to the same language family. So, anyway, so these people then also speak a second language or a third language, which is one of the more native languages of Africa. But they also don't speak those languages well. Because then, as I got to know my students a little bit, they would say, well, we really like to speak English, because that is the language of American culture, hip-hop music, and that's really the language of the country where we want to emigrate. And as far as our native language is concerned, well, you know, I can order a beer, and I can order a pizza, but a philosophical conversation, or meaning I can't have in my native tongue. Strange situation. There you have people who are alienated, not only from English, one could say, well, obviously, that's a foreign language for them, but they are alienated from their mother tongue, which is a very strange concept. So perhaps they don't have a mother tongue. So my conclusion here is that there can be certain political and economic situations in which people have no mother tongue. They have no language that is really their original language in which they can with ease and accuracy and so forth express themselves. Now that's a colonial situation that you could say, very unusual, that people should be alienated from language in such a radical manner. Let's look at a different situation. Let's look at, just for a second, the situation in the United States and what the relationship is between us. I'm also an American citizen. I had the privilege a couple of years ago of waving the little flag, and I don't say that in any ironic way. I'm quite proud of being an American citizen. But at any rate, so I can speak as a fellow American to fellow Americans about the situation of language in the United States. Well, are we alienated from, still the majority of the American population speak English, of course there are also people who speak other languages, but it's still the majority of Americans speak English. So I could say clearly that's our mother tongue. No alienation, no sense that the language is not ours, that it's being taken away, that we don't have possession of it, that it is something strange, and so on and so forth, the way in which it is in Uganda. But then once you look a little bit more closely at this, and analyze the state of language, you will find that perhaps the situation is a little bit different. Here's a little anecdote. In April 2009, a blogger, whom you may not know, I didn't know him before, I read, you know, a few books on this topic, by the name of Leo Babauta, used a particular phrase. The phrase is, feel the fear and do it anyway. in an online blog. It's a Zen-inspired blog. And the blog had a little paragraph which said, in bold, just do it. And then he explained further, to repeat, feel the fear and do it anyway. To beat the fear, you have to do just that. See below for some tips on doing this. But what works for me is not thinking, just acting. So Babauta, you know, whatever the value of this advice, posts this little phrase, feel the fear and do it anyway, and thinks nothing of it. A few days later, he gets a letter from an attorney. The attorney represents Susan Jeffers, PhD, author of a book entitled Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. The letter contains the legal threats. Unless Babauta takes the phrase off, or marks it with a little R sign encircled, indicating in a footnote that this is the trademark phrase of Susan Jeffers, PhD, he will have to pay a very, very large fine. So, this is, of course, as now, just now that you start thinking about it, it's not at all unusual. What's now begun to happen, not just with regard to this phrase, but others, and I'll read you a couple of examples just in a second, is that there are that there is a growing portion of the English language that we no longer own, but that is rather owned, now in this case it was owned by Susan Jeffers, PhD, but typically owned by corporations. And these corporations tell us that certain phrases we are no longer allowed to use. I'll give you a couple of examples of phrases that we're no longer allowed to use. One is, let me see. I cannot use the pun.
Just Do It belongs to Nike, doesn't it?
No, that may be. But if you want a very, very, what should I say, simple phrase, of which no one would suspect that it really is owned by anyone, it's, hey, it could happen. Hey, it could happen. It's trademarked under number 7456-8193 by the McDonald's Corporation. So, if you want to say, hey, it could happen, in a significant context, in a personal conversation. No. But if you want to use it in an ad, or as a book title or something like that, the McDonald's Corporation is going to sue you. The phrase doesn't belong to you. I may also not use the pun, do us a flavor, because that is owned by Frito-Lay. If I say, everyone doesn't like something, but no one doesn't like Philip Roseman, that's trademarked by Hillshire Brands. I could go on and on. I mean, kind of at the end of the day, if I continue with examples, I would just bore you. Also because we know it, it's not necessary that I give you examples, because we know the vans that drive up in front of the house to drop off furniture or to pick up laundry, whatever it may be, which say, the laundry that launders really white stuff, dear. And so the phrase no longer belongs to you. Very, 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 very strange. But clearly that's alienation. That is to say, we've been given this language by whom, really, no one in particular, I guess by the culture and tradition of the English-speaking world, which has handed down to us the use of the English language, and then corporations come along and take what we thought really belonged to us and make it a legal offense to use particular phrases. So, point, therefore, is, you thought language was only alienated, let's say, in colonial situations where, you know, other languages were imposed so that the people lost their original language. No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. So, the first point, therefore, is there are certain economic situations, political situations, in which alienation from another tongue can occur, and it doesn't look particularly healthy. That I'm no longer allowed to say, hey, it could happen, it seems rather strange. But there's something else. Alienation, one could say, is not only a kind of disease that can set in under particular, as I said, economic and political circumstances, but it's a structural characteristic of all human speech. As soon as I open my mouth, I'm alienated in a certain sense. By the way, let me repeat, what exactly does alienated mean? So that is, of course, that is not unimportant, that I don't use that term too vaguely. Alienos is the other. So I think that something really expresses my own self, really belongs to me, and it turns out that I'm alienated from it. In other words, There is an otherness, there is an influence of another that impinges on what I thought was my autonomous sphere of action. That's more or less what I mean by the term alienation. So all language is alienating. It's kind of sobering once you think about it. Even the deepest emotions that we want to express and of which we think that they express something absolutely individual that characterizes, let's say, a relationship between me and my closest loved ones, turns out to be often a cliche that's used by 1 million other people and doesn't express anything about me, but rather makes me part of a very, very large group so that my individuality gets put in question. Example, I love you. Well, it's nice to say that. How many people have said that before me? And how many people are going to say that after me? It's a bit cliched. By the way, I don't know if you've experienced that in your own lives, perhaps you have. When it comes to the expression of emotion, such as love, but also hatred, what should I say, deep human emotion, sometimes it's actually difficult to put it in words because even if you haven't reflected on it philosophically, you get a sense that I'm just uttering a cliché. And you don't want to utter a cliché. My gosh, apparently what I'm saying is either the curse shattering or some higher power is protesting and depriving me of life. So, at any rate, so let me try to continue. Unless the higher power continues protesting. This doesn't just apply, of course, to terms such as love, which one would hope are so unique and individual, but it's, of course, a characteristic of all language. I stand up and I say, I'm a philosophy professor, using these abstract concepts that can be applied to 10,000 other people. And I thought I was this unique philosophy professor. Well, if I say I'm Philip Roseman, sure. How many Philip Rosemans are there? Well, probably a few. I mean, not 10,000, but, you know, if you open the telephone book of New York, probably some, right? But again, even with the personal name, where is the uniqueness of it? So as soon as I speak, I introduce a dimension of universality and abstraction into the expression of self that really ultimately is incompatible with the individuality that I want to express. Speakers of English and of other languages know that. And you know what we do in order to counteract this sense that we have? We create private languages. I think we all have them. If I come up with an example from my own family, perhaps you'll just find it funny, which would be the point. But if you think about ways in which you express sometimes everyday things in your family circle, or to your partner, or to your children, etc., you will notice that you have come up with strange terms that probably no one else would understand, and you do that in order to express your individuality and not let it be crushed by these abstract universal terms. You probably, I hope, you're coming up with examples now in your own minds. My own example is my father, of course, talk German, obviously. He had this strange way of, don't be nuts as a kid, he would refer to our dishwasher as the washing chest. Now, I could give you the German term, the washing chest. And of course, we would come to be used to it and say, well, let's put the stuff in the washing chest. And everyone would know, okay, the washing chest. No one else, of course, had the slightest clue as to what that might mean. But it was a way of affirming and something like a little individuality of our family to create these strange terms. Do you know who else speaks a private language? Poets do. Sometimes in ways that are subtle, poets want to, you see, language comes to be reduced in everyday use by people who are not poets, who don't know how to use it artistically. Language becomes to be a string of stereotypes and just abstractions and so forth that's no longer capable of capturing the individuality that we want to express. Therefore, we need poets who recapture that kind of power and force of language. And they have to subvert and really challenge our everyday ways of speaking. Here's an extreme example of a poet doing something extreme to the English language in order to make it his own. Not just say what everybody else has already said. Some of you will recognize it. River run past even deadens, from swerve of shore to bend of bay, brings us by a commodious vicus of recirculation back to Howth Castle and environs. Sir Tristram, Violet Amors, vrow of the short sea, had Posnacore rearrived from North America, on this side of the scraggy isthmus of Europe Minor, to wield a fight his peninsular war. Nor had Topsaw's rocks by the stream exaggerated themselves to Lawrence County's gorgias while they were in Dublin that month all the time. Nor a voice from the fire bellowed, "Mish, mish, to toff, toff, to a Patrick." James Joyce. Fiddling Against the Wind. There you see something else, private language. So he's fiddling it to make it impossible to read, obviously, because it is a private language, you really can't get in there. You can study it sentence by sentence over years. Sometimes reading groups can do it. It's interesting. But it really requires deciphering. The language is so much James Joyce's that you can't get in there anymore. You know what else is ultimately nothing but a private language? This text, if you didn't know it was by James Joyce, you might already give you an idea of that. It's madness. Madness is nothing but private language. A person who lives in a universe that may be completely rational and logical within itself, but no one understands it. No one understands that I've written it for you. Sorry, I told you, but... anyway, or a snail. But for me, it makes complete sense. I'm Napoleon. This little language game, as Wittgenstein would say, for me, it makes complete sense. So, if you're creative with language, a poet has to be creative with language. I think we all have to be creative with language so that we don't end up really speaking like Washington politicians. Well, frankly, that's what it boils down to, you know.
The hard-working American family.
So we have to be creative. If we become too creative, we're going to be perceived as mad. Because it's too extreme. So, that's a little way of counteracting alienation. You know? So all language is structurally alienating. Let me just make perhaps one remark here. Quick, perhaps. There's one significant philosopher who has made this topic, language as such is alienating, into the key of his entire system, and that's the famous psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan. Have you heard of him? Are you aware of him? He is a very, very, very interesting psychoanalyst, more interesting in my opinion than Freud, because Freud's philosophical background, Freud was brilliant of course, but he hadn't done much philosophical reading. It boiled down really in Freud's case to Schopenhauer. It wasn't much more. Lacan has read the Western philosophical tradition pretty much. And so he gives you a psychoanalysis that is much more powerful simply conceptually. And also has many, many more insights. And what Lacan says is, basically, you're psychologically alienated as soon as you enter into language, which he calls the symbolic. As soon as I say I have already exteriorized myself in a word that's not my own, that makes me part of a linguistic universe that I can't claim as, you know, my expressing my individuality anymore. So that then, we lead a life that is characterized by a certain duality, the life that I lead as a person who expresses himself in regular language, and something, the unconscious, that remains unexpressed in that language. And the unconscious occasionally wants to come forward, break through that alienation, in fraudulent slips, for example, or in embarrassing silences or something like that. So according to Lacan, language becomes authentic when you don't speak anymore, or between the lines. So you utter lots of nonsense, you know, clichés, blah, 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 blah. Then you suddenly, well, which we often do. It's what we're stuck with so often, right? But then suddenly, hesitate. Then the psychoanalyst would say, okay, why did he hesitate there? And somebody couldn't speak anymore. Or instead of my mother, I say, you know, my beer. Aha, he's confusing mother and beer. What could that indicate? The unconscious speaks some kind of language, as Lacan would say, which we have to start reading. But again, there you see what the point that I'm trying to make. First of all, it's interesting if you want to have a look at Lacan. He makes this very, very, very powerful use of the idea according to which language is alienated. Second point I want to make about Lacan is, just as the poet and the madman break through the alienating character of language, so does the unconscious in Freudian slips, silences, and Lacan at one point says, Lacan always liked him. He liked this more regular way of speaking. When he came into the classroom with his red coat, well, he was a bit eccentric. Lacan says, the truth only speaks between the lines. The truth is only between the lines. Because everything you say is ultimately cliché. So how do you utter the truth? By insinuation, indirectly. through collocations and so forth. Anyway. All right. Now, why are we alienated from language? Now I'm going to, you know, I'm a professor at the University of Dallas. The Catholic University for Independent Thinkers. So I cannot, you know, go here without having brought in religion. That's impossible. So, I'll be fun at my own university. So, according to not just Christianity, but really many religious traditions, and again I hesitate to say all religious traditions because that's very arrogant. Who knows all religious traditions? I certainly don't. But let's say according to Christianity and according to many religious traditions. You know, human beings are structurally, fundamentally alienated in their existence. We're not what we were supposed to be, and that's because we transgressed in some horrible way. Now you would say, well, that's just, okay, perhaps that's just... It's strange, though, that that seems to be a kind of universal in human cultures. In, of course, Christianity, you have the story of the fall, you know? There's the Garden of Eden, and there's temptation, and the temptation really is ultimately pride. It's not the stupid fruit or something like that, but rather what it's about is not to do what I was asked to do. I was given everything, except just don't do that one thing. Mm-hmm. And as you know from children, I know it from my point. You tell people, do anything, just be welcome, but please, just not bother. Big pedagogical mistake. Mm-hmm. I have a pond in my yard, with a little fountain and snails in the pond. And kids sometimes come, neighborhood kids. I went out to the kids years ago already, not yesterday. I said, hey, you're welcome, please do feel free to play in my yard. You're very welcome, I have no problems with that. And you know, of course, you know, play at the pond and, you know, look at the fish and so on. And just one request. You know, the snails need to be in the water, especially in the Texas heat. Don't take them out and let them dry out, they'll just die. They say, oh yeah, that's okay, thank you. So, okay, I go off to work. Come back in the evening from the university, having taught by Aristotle or whatever, lined up beside the pond, the dried up. Well, original sin. You may do anything, but this one thing, just don't do this one thing, which is completely insignificant, because what are the dried out snails? Nothing. And they take the dried out snails and put them on the pond. So, there you go. So, I lived in Africa. The Africans also have different stories. Christianity, you know the story that Christianity has. Here's one of the many African stories from a book on African thought. One version of the myth, quotation from a book on African thought, I have the bibliographic reference if you want, says that God's dwelling place, that is to say the heavens, was very close to earth. So close that when a woman was pounding yam, she constantly knocked the top of her pestle against the face of God. Any attempt to discourage her from lifting the pestle too high proved abortive. So God withdrew. So then you have this woman, and she's pounding the yam. And God says, sorry, that's my face. And she's just pounding the yam. That's my face. So she's just, you know, that's the, she just wants to hit God's face. And God says, okay, I'm going. Similar story, structurally the same. Now, so perhaps, you know, we are alienated. So perhaps that's the inside of these religious traditions. Not perhaps that we've ever possessed this state in paradise. Perhaps that's itself mythical. But there seems to be this insight that somehow we're broken. You know the famous story, I mean everyone talks about it, I mean, you know the story that Aristophanes tells in Plato's Symposium? The famous story about the spherical human beings who rebelled against the gods? You know that story? It's the same story. It's beautiful, by the way. Okay, still have a few minutes. I'll tell you that story. Plato's Symposium is a series of speeches on love. One of the speakers is Aristophanes. And Aristophanes has to explain what love is. And he says, you know, love is really this. Originally, human beings were spherical. They were balls, essentially. That is to say, two of us now fused together with two heads, four arms, four legs, generally, blah, 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 all doubled. Two sets of eyes, two sets of ears, blah, blah, blah. We were incredibly powerful, first of all, because we were able to move ourselves forward so quickly. Then instead of having 2 ears, we had 4 ears, and we see in all directions, blah, blah, blah. So we rebelled against Zeus, because we felt so powerful. And Zeus doesn't like it, the rebellion. just as the African god is like the pestle in his face. So Zeus doesn't like the rebellion and says, okay, we're cutting you in half. Zeus has all these spherical human beings cut in halves. And now, here's a kind of interesting little politically correct part of the story. The ones who were all male, we look for a male partner, the two men. The ones who were all female, will of course be looking for a female partner. And only those that were sexually ambiguous anyway, they'll turn out straight. It's an interesting little part to the story, isn't it? It tells you something about the Greek understanding of sexuality, which wasn't quite the same as ours. So, but at any rate, it's an interesting. So now I run around in my whole life looking for, use the expression, my other half. I'm trying to find the other half, and Plato describes it beautifully. I find it, and I think, oh, yeah, it's this one. It's this. Oh, no, it's not. And even when I found the other half, there can be some kind of union, of course, but not a permanent one. So even if I bring about a union for a while, I separate again. Sadness. Beautiful story, isn't it? So again, really, I'm tempted to say wherever you turn, but I don't say it because I don't know wherever. Many places where you turn, you have these stories of human brokenness. It just seems to be the truth, really. But what's particularly interesting, language. It talks not just about human brokenness, it's about language. One thing that's interesting about the Bible is that one of those stories about human rebellion, punishment, and therefore brokenness, has to do with language. It's the Babel story, the Tower of Babel in Genesis. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you recall the story, I just copied it here from an old-fashioned version of the Bible that really conservative Catholics use. It's called the Dewey Advance version. And some people use it because it's linguistically beautiful. One of the problems, if you open a religious text and it talks to you the way, sorry for saying that again, a Washington politician talks, you're thinking, that's God? They sound like God. You want something that's a little bit more elevated linguistically. So anyway, so that's why, for example, Anglicans and so forth would use the King James Bible, but not the most recent translation into regular American English. So from Genesis, and the earth was of one tongue and of the same speech. And when they removed from the east, they found a plain in the land of Sennaar and dwelt in it. And each one said to his neighbor, come, let us make brick and bake them of stones and slime instead of mortar. And they said, come, let us make a city and a tower, the top whereof may reach to heaven. And let us make our name famous before we be scattered abroad into all lands. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of Adam were building. And he said, behold, it is one people, and all have one tongue, and they have begun to do this, neither will they leave off from the designs till they accomplish them indeed. Come ye, therefore, let us go down, and there confound their tongue, that they may not understand one another's speech. And so the Lord scattered them from their place into all lands, and they ceased to build the city. And therefore the name thereof was called Babel, because there the language of the whole earth was confounded. And from thence the Lord scattered them abroad upon the face of all countries. So, same structure as all these transgression stories. Human beings are too powerful, just as the spherical human being in Plato was too powerful. But why are they too powerful? Well, it manifests itself in the construction of this tower, which, by the way, as in the African myth, the face of God is struck. It reaches too high. It comes, the myth will say God is in heaven. So God's up there, so if you go too high, you're going to disturb God's peace or something, right? It goes too high. So what does God do? He doesn't like it. But now I've read some scripture commentaries. God doesn't destroy the tower. That's the interesting thing. That's not part of the story. The story does not say a God came down and was really annoyed by this transgression, destroyed the tower. It's not there. That's just not what it says. It says God came down and scattered them so as to reduce their power. Now, this is of course a matter of interpretation. But one famous commentator by the name of Carl Westermann says, what does it mean that God doesn't... First, it means it's not about God's dignity having been violated or something like that. That's not what God is about, etc., etc. This biblical scholar refers to a funny little talk, a famous movie, Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Has anyone here watched that movie? Fritz Lang's Metropolis uses the Babel motif. It's basically a modern city. It's a movie from 1927. It's silent. It's a modern city, industrialized, and it's full of pride. And the pride shows itself also in the height of the buildings and so forth. But the movie is not about really God. Fritz Lang wasn't a particularly religious person. It's about economic oppression. There are these prideful people who live high up in the skyscraper, you know, have all comfort, and down below the skyscrapers in some underworld, you have the workers toiling away. And so Westerman, the commentator, takes his cue from that and says, so the Baal story is not really about God having been offended, because if you believe in God, then you can't really offend God. I mean, what does it mean to offend God? That's not very meaningful as a concept. What it is about is God fearing that this unified human race would itself become dehumanizing. They would create some kind of totalitarian regime in which everybody would subjugate it. Therefore, it was better for the benefit of the human race to scatter them into smaller groups where they could cancel each other out. One interpretation, I'm not saying that's the interpretation of the story, but it kind of seems to make sense. So, what would that mean for what, you know, what I'm trying to say about language and alienation? It would mean that the Babel story itself, the fact that we speak different languages is alienating. It really is, isn't it? That is to say, have you ever traveled to a country where we really couldn't speak English? It's happened to me only once. Even here, I speak French, but when I go to Paris and I sit down at a restaurant table, they see that I'm not French, apparently I don't look French. They say, good morning, would you like a coffee? And I said, French, and why do you speak English to me? I don't want to speak English, I'm in Paris. So, anyway, that's why. So, but it can be, I traveled once to Taiwan, and there no one spoke English. That was really interesting. You know, you hail a taxi, and the taxi stops, and you say, could you take me to the such and such hotel? And they say, oh. And actually what they do is they give you a little business card. The hotel will give you a business card that you carry with you, and you stick it under the driver's nose. Say, you know, hello, how are you doing? Stick the business card in the driver, says, and starts driving in the right direction. So, anyway, but not sharing a language can be alienating. Imagine the attempt to communicate with a person, and the person has no clue what you're saying. It's not fun. So that is a kind of alienating experience. But at the same time, perhaps the multiplicity of languages is also something like a gift. Perhaps if we all spoke the same language, we would be deprived of all kinds of things. First of all, cultural diversity. Everyone speaks English. Fine, no good, so I don't need to learn foreign languages. But what about French culture and German culture and Chinese culture and Indian culture and African culture and blah, 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 blah? They all wouldn't exist. So, perhaps, from a simply philosophical point of view, theological point of view, you know, to heighten God's glory or something like that, you create this multiplicity of cultures and peoples. Secondly, that prevents, or is a way, of making sure totalitarian regimes have a somewhat harder time. At least if they want to dominate you, they have to dominate 500 different groups of you. Rather than just one. If you dominate the Americans, you still have to dominate the French, and if you're done with them, the Russians are still left. So, et cetera, et cetera. So, therefore the point is this. Perhaps, 2 points, really. Perhaps the alienation turns out to be a kind of gift. We are linguistically alienated, but perhaps that's actually not such a bad thing. Perhaps it is a kind of gift. Second, point one. Point B, how to counteract, what's the word? Undesirable forms of alienation, such as the ones I talked about at the beginning. You know, the colonial country that no longer has any language to, or a situation in a country such as the United States where certain phrases are trademarked so that you cannot use anymore. Well, the recognition really that language doesn't belong to you, it doesn't belong to me, it certainly doesn't belong to McDonald's, to Hillshire Farms, but it's a gift from beyond. Because then you see, I can't claim it for myself, you can't claim it for yourself, but we have to say, we're all indebted to some beyond that we have to respect and honor, which gives us this gift. Now you would say, perhaps, I don't know the group, you would say, wow, this religious stuff, I mean, the Irish, when they don't like something, they say, bring the bucket.
So, as you at that point, bring the bucket.
He's coming with the religious stuff. But here's an interesting point. It's not just religious people who would, of course, say, of course language comes from God. But certainly Christians would say that. The second person of the Trinity happens to be the Word. So language and God are rather a relatively close relationship there. But at any rate, how about poets? Poets tend to have this sense that language comes from a beyond, not necessarily the Christian God or something. But what about ancient poets? They constantly invoke the muses. Homer begins by invoking the muses. Homer thinks that Homer hasn't made the Iliad and the Odyssey. He thinks it comes from the muses. And this is where the song comes in that we're going to play now. He's a contemporary poet who is not some kind of religious fanatic. In fact, I don't know if you know him, Leonard Cohen, he's a horrible womanizer. And very pious, too. He's a strange guy. And a Buddhist, too. Do you know him?
Yes.
He's quite brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
He's quite brilliant. And so, his latest CD, which I think came out just last year, it's called Old Ideas, because he's now old. He's kind of over 80. His way of putting that is, hope you don't mind, I now ache at the places where I used to play. Well, he has this strange sense of humor. Well, but at any rate, he has this song, very strange song about old age, where he's thinking about dying, about human finitude. And he claims explicitly the song came from God. Now you can say he's mad, but before you say he's mad, listen to the song, and then perhaps we can talk a little bit about the song. And then you tell me what you think about it. The song. Something wrong.
Play the track.
We need the voice.
Yeah, it's like it's just one channel. That's the music, I hear.
No, it's not.
It's not the music?
It's the music
when
you're the lyrics.
You're on
the
side of the
musical track.
Well, maybe let's see if we can find the other one. That was track.
Why don't you stop it and try it on this one? In case the CD is
for well, now there's some music. Now some voice coming. No, it's not.
You're putting a stereo signal into a monaural amplifier.
Well?
Yeah, that's the problem. The amplifier you're using is not stereo.
Stereo.
Voice track is not
that. Well?
Just
well, it'll plug in, but it's going to give the same output, though.
No,
yeah, it's not even patched.
But it'll be different, though, because it'll be...
Mine
will
be
accurate.
Yeah, as long as I put it through that amplifier, it's
going to
come out. Just
well, it's... where's your... Okay, here's the... we can try this, I guess. Let's see what this does. All right.
He's a sportsman and a shepherd. He's a lazy bastard.
suit. But he does say what I tell him, even though it isn't welcome. He just doesn't have the freedom to refuse. He will speak these words of wisdom like a sage, a man of vision, though he knows he's really nothing but a brief elaboration of a tune. Going home without my sorrow, going home sometime tomorrow, going home to where it's better than before. Going home without my burden, going home behind the curtain, going home without the costume that I wore.
He's a lazy bastard living in a suit. His father was a tailor, so he always wears a suit. But I mean, why are we playing the song? The song, primarily the first line. I love to speak this language. There is this poet who has the audacity to say that God likes to speak with him, that the person speaking in the song is God. So again, what does this mean? It means that there is a long tradition in poetry, in creative people, that there is something beyond them that's going on, that there is something else that's speaking through them, that language doesn't belong to them. The beauty of poetic language is precisely that it's a language that has this transcendent element in it, wherever that comes from. A psychoanalyst would interpret it differently from a theologian and so on, but there is this extra element. Thank you so much for your interest. I've been delighted to see you.
Thank you for the questions. Here at the Dallas Washington Forum, we let us talk as well. But I just ask that we keep the Shakespearean soliloquies down to a bare minimum and get to our questions. So, right?
Yes, are you familiar with the language of politics, that being neurolinguistic programming, where everything a politician says is cloaked in ambiguity, which means that the listener fills in the blanks the same way that a poet does.
Uh-huh.
So if you make your terms ambiguous enough, the listener, and presumably God, will fill in the blanks for you.
Yeah, but there's a difference. I mean, there's a difference. The language of the politician is empty because it has no content. The language of the poet is ambiguous because it has infinite content. See, what is the greatness of a work, of literature, by the way, also of art? Why is Plato's Republic a great work, but also why is a Shakespeare play a great work, and so forth? Because it really contains inexhaustible meaning. Every generation can go back to it, and it is rich enough to be reinterpreted by each generation. If I say something that is completely unambiguous, I'm Philip Roseman, a philosophy professor at the University of Dallas. Well, that's accurate, but it's very boring, and it's not going to be reinterpreted by anyone in 100 years. Neither, I would contend, is anyone going to be interested in the politician's, whatever it is, speech in 100 years. Because it is not, it doesn't have any excess meaning in it, but it's rather a poverty of meaning.
Yeah.
There's not enough there. We all care about the hardworking American family. Well, that's not enough, sorry. Right?
Great.
Well, Professor, I have two thoughts that are related. We think in a language, okay? And so our thinking is kind of limited by our vocabulary. So I must have a word or a concept. If I don't have that word, I can't express it. I'm a writer, so, you know, sometimes there's a word from what I want to say, but I can't. And Shakespeare didn't have that problem. He just made up a word.
Right.
Jared Diamond, in his book, the last book, the world before yesterday, was speaking about the loss of languages that, you know, in the world. You know, more and more languages are disappearing.
Right.
The last speaker is dying. And that he says that people who speak more than one language, that are fluent in more than one language, have a richer world. They can think, you know, more widely. So what do you have to say about that? Being, you know, bilingual and having, you know, loss of that fluency in several languages.
Well, I would say a number of things. First, I think we have to be careful. Language is indeed a very, very important way for us to think about ourselves, but it's not the only one. Musicians, painters, sculptors, give me other examples, other art forms. Those are ways of reflecting on human existence in a manner that's not linguistic. So language is certainly a privileged and widely used way of thinking about human existence. It's not the only one. So that's the first thing I would say. I think it's important. For me, for example, as a professor, it's important. Why? Well, not that my classroom is of great interest to you. I have some students who write well. Other students who write extremely poorly. The ones who write extremely poorly are not necessarily making intelligence. They may be excellent painters and be really excelling in the art department. They just can't speak well. And still, they have a way of thinking about the world. Second point, a language teacher in Ireland, in some mythical past. I lived in Ireland for a while. And Ireland was at that time certainly a kind of half-mythical country. So father such and such said to father such and such, repeated to father such and such what father X had said. And so one of these fathers at the university where I was teaching said, learning another language is like acquiring a new soul. Which is true. Learning another language is like acquiring a new soul. And anyone who speaks another language knows that it's true. If you say you speak English and you've learned Spanish, or your native language is French and then you've learned English, it's not just a matter that you say something in French which you then translate into English with more or less difficulty. But you will think differently in French. You will say different things. It's a different world in which you live. So, therefore, if we suffer from linguistic impoverishment, both within a single language, but also in the human community as a whole, that does mean a loss of richness in our appreciation of the world in which we live. I think that's definitely true.
So you had talked about your experiences in Africa and the richness or dearthness of the language. Do you find that some of these African languages, that there was not a word for phenomenology, or there's not a word for existentialism, and how did you deal with that?
Well, first of all, languages that don't have these kind of Western terms, simply, you typically just imitate the terms. I'll give you one example. I learned a little bit of Arabic when I was an undergraduate. The Arabic word for philosophy is falsafa. That's philosophy, isn't it? It's just they didn't have a word for it, so they called it falsafa. We didn't have a word for orange, so we used naranj, which is the Arabic word. So that's what happens. I mean, exchange among different languages if we don't have the term.
I was he, like he always did, he took my question, and I thought it was fascinating. For me, it was, how many different languages do you speak?
I speak three.
Okay. For me, it was because the topic is language alienation in itself. Does the difference in language alienate you from thoughts? I'm receiving any thoughts. You might not be getting any certain kind of thoughts that if you spoke a different language, you would receive during the course of your life. So that was my question. It may be less specific than his.
Right.
But let me go on to something else. Language alienation in itself, if we could go back, say, a million years, because language had to start somewhere. Is not language alienation the cause of the more complicated speech as time goes on? Isn't it alienation itself that creates language and the more specific complications that will arise as time goes on?
I hope I understood your two questions properly. Well, the first is this. It's a very, very interesting remark that Hegel made. Hegel in the 19th century talked about the nature of languages. He wasn't a linguist, but he made a very, very, very good point. Whatever language you use, you look at. As languages develop historically, they become simpler and simpler. That's one interesting point. Their grammatical difficulty decreases. If you look, for example, at one of those African languages, they are extremely difficult to learn. For example, they will have words, of course it doesn't even exist in English anymore. Even in German, you have words that are masculine in gender, feminine in gender, and that are neuter. And then if you utter a noun that's masculine, you have to make sure your adjective matches that noun. And that can be, I'm German, so it's not that hard, but it can be hard. In English, you just, it's everything is the, the man, the woman, the child, the guy. So, not very difficult, but, so English is, by the way, English itself has undergone, of course, a process of simplification, as you know. When you Shakespeare, but even if you then go back a little bit further, read Chaucer, it was already a little bit more difficult at that point. So that's one thing. Languages become simpler. The second point that's very interesting, speculation about the origins of language. It's one of those questions. There are theories. Two leading theories. One theory is that language originated in intergenerations. So some primitive human being met, a bear or something threatening. So, okay. Or some human being, ate a particularly nice food. It's like, And this then evolved into more complicated words. That's one explanation. The other explanation is so-called onomatopoeic. All words originally imitate that which they express. We have onomatopoeic words, but it's not. For example, knock, 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 knock. Or to snore, snore. But the word snore seems to imitate the snore itself, etc. So, first of all, it works only for certain words. Secondly, we didn't have tape recorders back then. In other words, we're never going to know. It's one of those questions that we can ask and ask and ask. We will never know how language originated. There's no answer to it. It's just not possible. It's kind of fascinating. Also, by the way, Leonard Cohen's song, emphasizes the ultimate lesson of philosophy. I don't know, you're the Dallas Philosophers Forum. I'm 49 now, I've done philosophy for a while. Ultimately, philosophy, in my opinion, doesn't boil down to all that much. You can analyze a lot with philosophy. I love philosophy. Philosophy is very, very interesting. However, ultimately what it teaches you is simply the radical finish of human existence. How little do we know? There's all that much to know out there. What do I know? It's not very much. It's not very much. That seems to be ultimately the language question is one of them. We speak language all the time, we use it all the time, it completely permeates our being. They ask, so where does it come from? It would be nice to know, wouldn't it? Yeah. We have no clue.
When we lost our fur, right? grooming was replaced by conversation.
Yeah.
It's my impression, in opposition to what David said, that most of my thinking, I think, is nonverbal, and I almost wonder what everyone else thinks, but I think translating it into words creates a sort of impoverishment of expression of my nonverbal thinking. I think a lot is lost when I try to put it into language. So most of my thinking, I think, is either emotional or direct observation. I don't think I consciously am thinking in words. I think when I talk to you, I have to put it into words, and something is lost when I do it. And I wonder if other people, what are your thoughts? Do you think we think in words, or do you think that's just our means of communicating with some other part of ourselves or with other people?
Oh, but isn't that, do we think in words? Not, I mean, I think it depends on who you are. Does an artist, let's say a painter, think in words? No. And then if you make an attempt to reduce the painting to words, you're making a mistake, because the painting is not a poem. And so if you're trying to then say, oh, the painting really means this and the other thing, well, why did the painter paint it instead of saying it? So I agree, I do not think that all thinking is linguistic. Now the other question is that, you see, also, I'm not a neuroscientist, and it's not my field, so I feel further comments on this.
You're lost for words.
No, not the lost for meaning, but insights for the words.
Can I ask, show of hands, do most people think they think in words? Most people think in words. How many think in words? How many think they think non-verbally?
Depends on what you're thinking about.
So it's not happening.
I'm a deep ball.
Well, it reminds me of the song lines where in Australia, the traditional Australian religion, it consists of this song. It's a very long song.
Uh-huh.
And when an Abba was born, they're given a piece of bark or stone with their part of the song on it. So wherever they go in Australia, when they meet other Aboriginals, they just start singing their song.
Uh-huh.
And all the other ones know who they are, where they come from, who their parents were, what their rights were, even though the songs are in 175 different languages. But they gather all this information from your part of the melody.
Interesting.
Yeah, this Chapman's song lines is very
question here.
Yeah, I've got a question. By the way, thank you for coming. You got me thinking in new ways.
Thank you for your interest.
Yeah, I've got a question about social maturity and language and alienation. When I was a very young person, I spoke out of context, out of social context many times, and my parents would reprimand me for it. It's not appropriate to bring those kind of things up in this setting. So things like appropriate discussions about religion to the right people, politics, using curse words. When I was a young man, many years ago, there was a comedian called George Carlin, and he made a comedic routine out of just repeating curse words, which were not permissible on the radio or TV. And I thought, well, maybe there have been breakthroughs in language, but I still feel a restraint, and I think others do too, socially, about how we don't want to feel ourselves alienated by the words we use. Could you comment about that?
The words that we find are offensive, that's, as you know, highly specific culturally. I don't know, I don't want to, well, I mean, I, you know, I don't want to offend anyone by using any words like that. I live in Oak Cliff. And perhaps you would be offended. Well, it's too bad. Well, it's, you know, honestly, I don't want to be impolite or anything. So I move into this neighborhood, walk around. The first greeting I hear is, hey, what's up, motherfucker? And it wasn't being polite. It was being a nice neighbor. Another term is highly specific, as you know. Is it offensive or not? Black people do not want to be called niggers by white people. They can call each other niggers. What's happening? So if I say it, it's super offensive. If someone else who's also black says it, it's fine. In some communities, to use the F word, I used to ride the bus before I got the car, it was always the F thing this, the F thing the other thing, the F thing the third thing. And I thought, well, do you have any other words available? Well, in some communities, everything that you want to qualify is effing. And they don't find it offensive. And I don't think there's an objective standard. I really think it depends on your community. There's a community standard. And your community doesn't say you are him.
My question was, dealt with this.
Right.
Why do we show such restraint to not alienate? I know the example you gave a very good example.
Yeah.
But I think most people, they show a restraint about the language they use because they do not want to be alienated.
Because there are cultural taboos in different communities.
I know the motive, but never mind.
Am I not getting the question?
Well, no, this topic of your discussion tonight deals with language and alienation.
Right.
I'm just saying maybe there are exceptions to that where there's restraint about using language so we don't alienate.
Yeah. So we don't alienate other people.
Yeah.
Right.
So you picked a different topic than I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, my topic was more the alienation of oneself from the self through language.
Okay.
More than, you know, often we use the term, I alienated this individual by saying the wrong word. It's slightly different.
I got it. Okay. Thank
you.
Okay. Any other questions? Have time for one more question? Okay.
On a completely different tack, I work with second graders and I try to encourage
you just want to close your mouth.
How's this?
That's good.
Okay. I work with second graders. I volunteer my time. And what I want to do is inspire them with a love of language and reading, because by the time they hit third grade, if they can't read, there's a 90%+ chance they'll end up in prison. Any inspiration on how I can inspire them to love the language, to love the words, to love to read, to want to try?
That's difficult. You know, that's a difficult question. One way of doing it is by speaking honestly yourself. You know, very often we do just repeat these cliches and these stereotypes. And people have an intuitive sense when that happens. It comes across as not authentic. You're just repeating some stuff. And I think people don't like that. If instead you speak in a way which communicates, your desire really to use language not to manipulate or to sell, but to speak the truth. And secondly, you speak with something like a reverence for language. And I'm not sure that necessarily has to do with correctness. I think that someone who speaks a different American dialect can speak with reverence for language, although we would perhaps say he's making lots of mistakes. It's more a sense that, as I said, language should be respected as this means to communicate truth and not simply a tool for manipulation. And when people sense that it's simply used to manipulate, they don't sell stuff, which is how we use it most of the time. They will come to disrespect language. And I think that's why we live now at a time when most people don't take words seriously anymore. They don't count for much.
Let's give a round of applause for that.